Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you. So our topic for the evening, though, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands of who traveled to see family or had family travel to see you for Thanksgiving. This is the truest meme I think I have seen. Bringing a deadly disease to people with little to no immunity is a very authentic Thanksgiving reenactment.
Yeah, really.
Hello. All those Europeans coming in.
That's exactly it, right? So we already all know, of course, that the sort of the Thanksgiving myth is false, right? The happy pilgrims and Indians celebrating a harvest together, which is not to say that that event didn't happen. It is not to say that Tusquantum was not a really big resource for the pilgrims early in their time. And that the Wampanoag probably did keep those people alive for longer than they, in retrospect, probably ought to have. This myth of, you know, the pilgrims arrived and everything was happy. We know, of course, particularly everything was happy between these European immigrants and the people who already lived in the land, in North America, that those relationships were almost never really happy. The 1621 Thanksgiving for Thank God We Didn't All Die was followed by other Thanksgivings. For instance, in 1637, Governor John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving for the massacre of hundreds of Pequot men, women, and children. And we know that genocide against Native Americans has been part of U.S. history since before there was U.S. history, right? So we know that this mythical Thanksgiving, when everything was perfect and everybody got along, really never happened. And even on those historical moments when there was, when there was a measure of harmony between the Anglo settlers and the indigenous folks who were already here, even in those moments, there was more tension in those moments than a lot of us are really willing to remember. So that's cheerful and uplifting. We're going to continue being cheerful and uplifting here. I do want to take a quick moment and just acknowledge where I am and whose land I'm on I'm actually kind of submerged in as I'm leading this class from a basement. So the land, looking around, I'm assuming you're all at home, the land on which we are all situated was originally inhabited by the Bahoji or Iowa Nation and the Sauk and Meskwaki peoples. And they took care of this land for generations before anybody who looks like us got here. They have been, since before we got here, this land had been claimed by European Americans, even just in principle, even before anybody knew exactly where this, European Americans knew where this land was. I'm actually going to start us with a talk by Mark Charles. Mark Charles is the son of an American woman of Dutch heritage and a Navajo man. And he's going to bring us through the misunderstood history of the phrase, we the people. The misunderstood history of we the people. So who really do we mean when we say we the people? And then we'll circle ourselves back around to the indigenous folks who are still right here in North America. That, of course, is one of those kind of part of the myth of that false Thanksgiving myth is that everything was lovely and now there are no more Native Americans around. And somehow we think of that as a story that was a success when the story didn't even happen, and to the extent it did, we shouldn't call it a success. So here's Mark Charles to tell us about the three most misunderstood words in U.S. history. I did not give you a heads up that we were going to deconstruct the entire United States of America in that TED Talk, did I?
No, but it's hard to argue with what he said.
It is, isn't it? I mean, we don't like that story. I don't like that story. I guess I shouldn't speak for anybody else, but I don't like that story. But boy, yeah, you hear him tell it. Bev, your mic is off. But yeah, you hear him tell that story and the pieces fit.
I said I liked it because I've not heard that. And to learn is our reason for being here.
And for being here anyway, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And to understand some of that, I'm sure there's those of you that are very familiar with it. I just ran across it this Thanksgiving for the very first time in my life. And I, you know, read it in the New York Times and I was appalled. And I thought, this goes in with that whole racism, LGBTQ, the whole thing is, it's almost, you know, darn it, we could have done a lot more, a lot younger in our lives to get this movement going. But it's better to be aware, to be aware.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think it's, I mean, that puts really well kind of why I wanted to bring this to you today, just as it's the Monday after Thanksgiving. And so we've been dealing with this systemic racism sort of throughout the fall, and it seemed incomplete not to spend some time on the systemic genocide that really is to borrow Dr. Gannon's phrase, it's baked into the cake. And the idea that the doctrine of discovery would be cited by the Supreme Court in 2005 that's hard for me. Go ahead, Sue.
Well, I was just thinking our history books need to be changed. I mean, because we were all taught a totally different view of all this. So it's our lifetime bringing up that we didn't know or didn't pay any attention. I mean, we knew that the Indians were killed. We knew about it, but we never thought about it. You know, we weren't taught to think about what really happened.
But even a year ago in South Dakota with the oil pipeline, most of us didn't go out there and protest. It happened around us and it wasn't on top of us. So you could kind of watch the news and shake your head and then go on. So it's still happening every day. We don't value the land, that little tiny pockets of land we let the indigenous people have.
which we let them have. Did you hear that?
Which is crazy. I know.
Oh, and it was the poorest land. I mean, it was nothing they could till the soil. You know, it couldn't.
I was shocked that Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote that decision.
Was too.
Yeah, that was a well-delivered little historical narrative, wasn't it?
He saved it till the end.
He's setting this all up and and then, you know, knowing, you know, as we could all put together kind of the assumed politics of the audience that he was preparing the speech to speak to, and said that, yeah, and it's your favorite justice that wrote this. I know she wasn't everybody's favorite justice, but you can tell that's why he was setting that up, that that this is so deep in our legal system. And she may not have, you know, without overturning a couple centuries of precedent, which probably needs to happen. I'm not on the Supreme Court, so I can say that. Without overturning a couple centuries of precedent, or, you know, really, what is that, 550 years of precedent, 570 now, without overturning that much precedent, she may have been stuck, right? Now, I don't know that we need to give her really the benefit of the doubt to say that, oh yeah, she really wished she could overturn the doctrine of discovery, but she was stuck. I think there's every reason to believe that when you're schooled in American law, when you're schooled in Euro-American law, that's what comes out.
In a male world at that time.
Yeah.
There's hardly been any reference to the fact that every time we talk about some group, even if we go back to pre-Christian times, some group dumping on some other group, the bottom line is always money. Now, the money may go with what color your face was, or who gave you the land, or whose God could set a fire when the other guy's God couldn't, but it always comes back to money. And that is, I think, part of why we are stuck where we are, but I don't have any idea how to undo that. I can honor the heck out of all the Indians who lived here, whose lands my forebears stole. But I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, you're probably right in the implication that the doctrine of discovery was at least functionally mercenary. Whatever Pope Leo thought he was saying, the way it got used was, you know, really focusing well in on those lines about if they're not Christian, you can enslave them. And then that actually created, you know, that gave heartburn to really well-intentioned American enslavers who really wanted to spread the gospel, but they had to figure out legally how to teach the gospel to, especially at that point, enslaved Africans who had been brought to the United States. Also, some others, including Native Americans. How do we teach the gospel to these folks, because we feel like we should, without losing all the cash value that they represent?
As the speaker said, we don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He wants to talk about it for a year. What happens then?
Yeah. So
that's a rhetorical question. If somebody has an answer, I'll be glad to hear it. But that was the question that occurred to me and is occurring to me anytime I get into a discussion like this. I've had a couple of online seminars about this. Seminars, not seminaries, about this stuff recently, and all of them provide interesting facts and interesting places to go with my thinking, but no solutions are offered. I don't know whether the world would be any better if I gave everything I owned back to the Indians and moved back to peasanthood in Germany or Scotland. I don't think that would help any.
So, and I'm not aware of many contemporary Native Americans who say that, yeah, giving the land back to the First Nations who stewarded that land for centuries before we got here, and sending us all back home. I know very few sort of Native writers and thinkers who would propose that that's actually something we should do.
To me, but that is the only rational thing to do. We stole it, we got to give it back.
Or reparations, I mean, giving them money for it is the only other thing that we could do. But that doesn't seem reasonable either.
It seems like the Indians don't really have a voice. I mean, there's a lot of Black leaders out there, you know, speaking for themselves, but, you know, you don't hear much about the Indians. And
did anyone see in the Register yesterday, I remember perhaps Saturday, but sometime recently, the article about how the Iowa, that is the remnants of the tribe that lived in Iowa, that moved out supposedly by agreement, but that's hokum, and that moved to northern Kansas and southeastern Nebraska, have bought some of their former lands back on what had been their reservation, and are going to try to establish what they called an Indian National Park. I read that and thought, well, that's interesting. It'll be educational, but then what?
So,
the fact that they had to buy it, that just
crazy. Well, the Meskwaki in Iowa bought a lot of their land back too.
Right. Yeah. So there's precedent for a native nation buying their land back, buying some of their land back. And the Meskwaki did that. I think it is important. I think Pam, sort of your reflection that that we don't hear, we in sort of the mainstream sort of Anglo world don't hear a lot of sort of native voices in sort of, you know, politics and public policy and so forth. I think that's correct that in Anglo media there's not coverage of native voices. I think it is important, particularly given that it's important to remember that they are still here. Many of the nations have been sort of forced onto reservations, which are not usually in their ancestral homelands. Particularly if you are, if you're east of the Mississippi, it's almost, or if you were east of the Mississippi, it's almost certain that you were forced westward at some point. And often at more than one point. The U.S. government and other European colonialized governments did the same thing. Canada has the same work to do. In Latin America, the dynamics are a little bit different. We won't get too deep into the way that that settlement and indigenous people groups related in Latin America, but certainly in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, and in New Zealand, several particularly places where the English were the colonial force, the process was to just move people and sort of compress them onto whatever land you didn't want. But many are still there. And some, including the Meskwaki, have sort of re-migrated back to their ancestral lands. So the Meskwaki settlement is a settlement, not a reservation, because they weren't stuck there, they bought it. But yeah, they bought their own land back from a colonizing nation that had taken that land without payment.
That sounds a little like Black people buying their freedom back.
Yeah, kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah. Tribal sovereignty is, I'm not going to, I mean, we don't need to actually get too deep into things like tribal sovereignty, but part of the unique situation of Native Americans in the United States is that they are sovereign nations. At least those that are recognized by the federal government. There are indigenous nations that are not recognized by the United States government and that are some of the work that they're doing is on a legal front is to obtain that recognition. There are also plenty of Native Americans who do not live on reservations or settlements that live in towns and cities and farmland, not on those defined sort of sovereign territories within the United States.
Mostly as a poor subclass.
Yeah. So the economics of being a Native American person in the United States are awful. The relationship with law enforcement of being a Native American in the United States is awful. The health outcomes associated with being a Native American in the United States are awful. And so all the work that we did in October, looking at the equity challenge, because of sort of the context in which we were talking about it, was primarily looking at the way that Blackness is written into law in the United States and written into the economics of the United States. Indianness is written into those same laws in very similar ways.
The speaker talked about we the people. And who were the we and who weren't the we. Mostly, I had forgotten, and I suspect most of us didn't know, that Native Americans only became citizens because we gave them citizenship in the 1920s or 30s.
24.
Before that, they weren't even citizens.
What were they considered?
Savages.
Whatever a non-citizen is.
I think
that's a very good question, and I don't have a good answer, but I think they didn't have voting rights, they didn't have property owning rights, they certainly were got the short end of the stick in the criminal justice system. So they were just considered expendable.
So they didn't have to pay taxes, real estate taxes, any kind of property taxes, anything like that.
Well,
if they couldn't own property.
If they could figure out how to own property, they would owe taxes on it. But except on the reservation.
That's tax-free, right? The reservations are tax-free.
That's sovereign territory. And the reservation system is super complicated because it's this weird sort of overlay of sovereignties, right? And so this actually, this is part of... not necessarily the greater exposure to police violence, but exposure to other kinds of violence are actually much worse on reservations because the jurisdiction is really ambiguous. It's not clear who has the power to enforce laws on the reservation because of the way that the Indian laws on the federal level are written.
and they don't pay taxes, so they don't have the good things that we get from taxes on a reservation either. And when they first moved tribes to reservations, they didn't look at commonalities in any way, shape, or form. So often it was a warring tribe and a farming tribe that ended up on the same little piece of land. And it was really, really difficult when the reservations were being established.
So I think probably the easiest way to say, before citizenship was established in what I found was 1924. That's at least when the right to vote on a federal level was granted. Some states denied the right to vote until in the 1960s. Probably the best way to describe them would be stateless, because within the territory of the United States, you know, there were these reservations where there was that really complicated amount of tribal sovereignty. But other than that, these were effectively non-citizens, but they weren't citizens of anywhere else either.
Well, in this last election, you heard about the government or the states affecting the reservations, how they could vote, where they could vote, how many voting stations. I mean, they had control over how they vote in our elections, and yet if they're a sovereign nation, then how can the United States tell them how they can, you know, how many voting stations they can have and where they're located and all that?
And that's a piece of that ambiguity. And our law doesn't do well with ambiguity. The question of, as you say, you know, how does voting for, particularly United States federal offices, what kind of sense does that make on a reservation? Well, it does make sense on a reservation. They're entitled to votes. When the Voting Rights Act was largely invalidated in 2013, on the grounds that it had done its job, a lot of those voter access issues really became a problem. And where did they become problems? In Black communities and Hispanic communities and on reservations.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So the question of, and I'm getting this, I should cite my source here. This is from the Native American Rights Fund, which is a legal advocacy group specifically on Native American concerns. And one of their big pushes is to maintain and often restore the voting rights that, as white people, we have taken for granted. As a white man, I've taken that for granted since forever. Women, you got it 100 years ago. And but the history since then has been a history of remembering that people who are not white should also get to vote.
Even with women, I think the feeling was that we grudgingly gave it to them. They had no right to it until we, the landowners and essentially whites, gave it to them. And I used to hear the phrase, I don't know whether it's used anymore. I hope it isn't used very much. That was very white of you. How many of you have you heard that phrase?
Oh man, it's been forever. Thank God.
I'm not seeing universal hands. I'm surprised. that I think was supposed to mean that you're being civilized and rational and whatever white people were supposed to be. And of course, sometime I figured out, wait a minute, that begs a question.
Yeah.
I think that's been, in some cases, replaced by the phrase, that's very Christian of you.
Yeah.
Which is also not a very good.
Yeah, right. That's going back to where anyone who's not Christian is subhuman.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. and that is...
Democratic or a Republican of you.
That phrase is used a lot by groups of Christians who, to my way of thinking, are not very Christian in their actions. Mm. To use their own definition.
Yeah, so... So that's a piece to also just be mindful of and you know, to remember where some of those pieces of that, again, sort of systemic genocide, you know, we talk about it as systemic racism and I would say that sort of, you know, looking at these legal structures and also kind of the, you know, the thought structures and the rhetoric that are really built around, and this was explicit at many points, the genocide of Native Americans. So for instance, part of the way of driving the Meskwaki and especially the Lakota people off the land was to drive the buffalo to extinction, right? I would say hunt, but that's too noble a word for what happened. Was it Jackson or Grant? Explicitly took it as policy to starve the Lakota people to death. That was the plan. It didn't happen. Again, thank God, right? The Lakota are still around and continuing to try to protect their water. Part of why we don't hear as much of a sort of prominent within the Anglo legal system, political system, voices from Native Americans is partly, I'll just grant this, that there is a tribal sovereignty system, that there is explicitly a parallel political process in which there is already tribal leadership. And so the Meskwaki Nation, for instance, they have their own political structure. They don't need ours in order to manage their internal affairs. So there really is a... you know, there is a sense of, you know, not that we should all get back on boats and go back east, but that we are where we are, they are where they are, and it is appropriate for us to say, this is your sovereign space, you are a sovereign people within this complicated way that we are related.
I find that unsatisfying. Because that's another
way of
saying...
It's not the whole answer.
No, to me, it is a way of saying, we've stolen all your stuff for 300-400 years. It's ours now. Try and get it back. And aren't we being white by giving you some rights? That's exactly right. The way that phrase would have been used.
Right. So where I...
Respond to something Sue said. Yeah. Sue said, how about reparations? Now, there's a word that's going to make people crazy.
Hang on just a second. We can come back to reparations. I will ask you the question, why does it make people crazy? But I need to say the second reason that it is probably harder for Native Americans to really get good standing, get good traction within the Anglo-American political system. And that is that the doctrine of discovery is being cited as Supreme Court precedent in 2005. And it is that the legal status of being Native American, partly because of this weird double sovereignty system. And partly because there's a whole lot of momentum behind this and a lot of cultural momentum behind the laws that make it legally more dubious to be Native American in this country, even than it is to be Black.
Yep.
And it is super legally dubious to be Black in this country. And so there are a few Native Americans in the federal legislature. Not all that many. Certainly not as many as there should be. So that is partly that's in the legal structure that that they're up against. So John, why does reparations drive us crazy?
Because we'd have to give stuff back. We stole it fair and square. I think it's just that simple. And then you can graft onto that the idea that, as Justice Ginsburg said, you should have asked about this 200 years ago. It's too late. You can graft all kinds of bizarre constructs onto that to justify why we don't have any responsibility, whether you want to say as white people, as people at all, as Christians. It's all
as humans.
As humans. Yeah, right.
Humans. Period.
Yes. That's a short answer, Nathan. Mm-hmm. We'd have to get stuff back.
Because it would involve giving something back.
Yeah. And if you want to say on top of that, well, they're not entitled to it. They didn't lose anything. I mean, they, a room full of present day people.
Right. They're not the ones I took it from. And besides which I'm not the one who took it.
Yeah. And we stole it fair and square 200 years ago. So why are we even talking about that? And before I forget about reparations, because this enters into what I'm saying, the only fair thing I've heard, basically fair thing I've heard about reparations to Native Americans would be that I'm going to come out with a wild guess. I'm going to say 35 or 40% of the land west of the Mississippi is owned by the government. We ought to give that all back to the tribes. Now, I don't know how to do that. I don't know what good it would do, but that's the only thing I can think of. Other than starting to tax everybody I see on this screen, 10% for the benefit of poor folks whose skin color is probably not the same as ours, and that just isn't going to sell. I'm starting to approach early middle age now. I'm starting to think of things I can do in my lifetime, and there aren't many. And one of them is not to convince my neighbors to start to pay a skin color tax.
Well, the reparation show goes on with the slaves, the blacks, and all of the Germans, the Jews. I mean, everybody is going to be entitled to something by the time we get done here.
Oh, sure. Oh, I can come up with a half a dozen ways right off that I'm entitled to reparations because some group has been mean to me or my ancestors.
Mm-hmm. What is the percent of Native Americans in our population? Does anyone know? In the population of the U.S.?
I'm going to guess 1%, but I'd be glad if somebody said, "You're full of beans, John. Here's the real figures." But that's the feeling I get.
Oh, I can 1%. Google it quick.
Yeah, give me a quick second to look it up. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I mean,
there are 2.8 million Native Americans in the United States.
That's out two-thirds of 300 of a percent. Million.
330 million.
Yep, that's 2/3 of a percent.
Not even.
I got to go back to a different thing. The wise nations build casinos so they can take the money from the white man.
I knew we would hear that tonight, Bruce. Somehow I knew.
Yeah. They don't all have the right to do that. I don't think the Meskwaki or the Iowa can do that. I could be wrong. The Iowa might be
the Meskwaki have one.
The Meskwaki is the one that's right.
Well, Meskwaki is very, very well organized. All of their people who have native blood are getting a big take from that casino and free education and free health care. They're getting all kinds of benefits. It's a very well run, very well run nation.
Nathan mentioned though the difference between a reservation and a what's the word you just used?
Settlement.
Thank you. Tammy's sitting here listening to this too. And she knows a little bit more about this because her father as a minister was involved with them a little bit. But anyway, I think the Meskwaki probably had to get permission. Now I visited an Indian, I guess they had to buy it too in Wisconsin, Tammy. Yeah, or it was set aside for them somehow. I'm not sure. I think they had a right to establish a casino, but not every tribe does, and not every Indian is a member of a recognized tribe, just to throw in a couple of more legal right. stumbling blocks.
Right, and yeah, that's important, particularly to Native Americans, that I don't care what family story you had passed down about how so-and-so was half Cherokee. If you are not a registered member of a Native American tribe, you are not Native.
I had a case.
That at least goes for y'all.
I had a case a couple of years ago where I found out, well, because as a lawyer, I'm supposed to ask this, although I bet it doesn't get asked very often, but I inquired whether the child to be adopted, and the circumstances don't matter, whether the child to be adopted had any Native heritage. And somebody said, well, they say her grandma was Indian, and that just raised all kinds of things we had to do. And my clients, the parents and grandparents, had no idea what I was talking about. They thought I was nuts. But we had to get a letter from maybe a Cherokee tribe, but yeah, whatever tribe grandma was probably from, saying she is not a recognized member of our tribe. And that was because she had relinquished it. See, there again, even there, time passes, the right of possession comes into play.
Right. And the reason for that law, that's the Indian Child Welfare Act, that one maybe did something right. Because it actually gave the tribes primary rights to their own children. Because there was a system of this was a means of genocide. The United Nations would call it such, of forcibly adopting out children from Native American tribes. And it was related to, it's the same work that was done by the boarding school system, where you would take all the Native children from wherever you got them, put them in a boarding school, teach them Anglo-American ways, teach them English, make them no longer speak their language. And that is, you know, that is cultural genocide as defined by the United Nations. And that was a system that, let me double check where that is, that continued through most of the 20th century. And the only, really only ended late in the 20th century, which was not too long ago.
Indian boarding school in Oklahoma when I lived there, but the kids came to our public school. I had an Indian boy in my sixth grade class.
Yeah,
the Meskwaki and their settlement have a right. Some of their kids go to the public schools, notably South Tama, but they have a right to go to the Meskwaki school. But they can't be kept from going to good old Iowa public school. And there are issues that had to be sorted out about that too.
And does the law still stand that if you are at least one quarter Native American, your college education is paid for.
No.
That is not true?
I've never heard of it, I'll put it that way. And I guess I've known enough Indian people when I went to school in Minnesota that I would have heard about it. Now, if somebody proves me wrong, great. But I don't believe that's true. I shouldn't say so strongly that's wrong, but I don't think it's true. And I've never heard of it before.
I don't, and it could have been an Anglo-Saxon, someone who told me in past generations.
I mean,
but I thought I had heard that, and I was like, why don't they take advantage of it? But
that sounds like state by state. And that might be true someplace like Louisiana or Oklahoma, for example. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard of it here in Iowa.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I will also just flag that that it is a common piece of racist rhetoric to say so and so doesn't pay their share in taxes and they get more than their share in public support.
Starting with poor people.
I'm not saying, Bev, that you are thinking that for racist reasons. I imagine that you heard that somewhere. But that's a very common piece of racist rhetoric. That it's one of those that once you start listening for it, it's in a lot of places, the idea that they don't pay their fair share and they get more than their share of benefits.
Oh no, I didn't have that base at all. I just thought
I don't think that's where you were coming from. I think you were legitimately saying, hey, I heard this somewhere. Is that true?
Yeah, that's all. That's where it lay. Yeah. That's where it is. Yes.
Well, you can go out during any school board election and hear somebody complaining about how the poor kids seem to think they have all the rights because they get free lunches. Same basis. It isn't racism. Exactly. It works out that way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
available to state residents, excuse me a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
8 ways you can go to college for free from CNBC.com. Available, you have native roots. Available to state residents who are at least one quarter Native American and enrolled in a federally recognized tribe. The waiver absolves eligible students from paying tuition at any 2 or 4 year public state institution, posted July 10 of 2012.
Then you are right with those restrictions. Whatever.
And that functions as a form of reparations.
Yeah.
That does specifically function as a form of reparations, assuming that the money for that comes from the sort of the general public coffers and is not, you know, somehow funded by the tribes or what have you. But
right.
But something like that is, you know, folks who have specifically proposed reparations and talked about how would we do that. Boy, funding education would be a huge way to begin reparations. It's not the only piece of the work, but that would be a huge way to begin those reparations.
Bev, does it say when that became law?
2012.
Well, no, that was
it posted. It was current as of.
Well, yeah. And if you just Google one quarter Native American college education.
I'll do that.
There was a whole lot more there than I was missing out on conversation, so I didn't want to keep resourcing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And good work finding a reputable source for your information too.
That's exactly right. But
we talk about information literacy at my house.
I like that. That's a good idea. Let's get some. And what are the ones that you can go to what sources are the best?
Well, ideally sources that you have heard of that you think both Bruce and Warren would consider real news.
Oh, really? Those are emails going back and forth that are old geezer emails. I'm not even looking at my network.
So CNBC is what I would describe as a reputable news source.
Oh, CNBC?
That's who the article was, right?
Yes, correct.
So, yeah, correct. I would believe that they have done some measure of reporting on that.
Gotcha.
So,
okay.
Gotcha. So, unfortunately, I probably have less of a what should you go do on Native American Day than I did at any point during the equity challenge and conversations about structural anti-Black racism.
What are you calling Native American Day? Excuse me for interrupting.
Today.
Today?
Not as a recognized
Today's
day.
Class.
The day on which we, contemporary issues, are talking about Native Americans.
Today's discussion.
Okay.
Today's discussion, yeah.
This is a powwow, okay?
I'm still thinking globally. I'm thinking, wait, what did I miss? Did they change? Did they change the Thanksgiving day?
There's a couple of dates that are Native American Day, depending on, or an Indigenous Peoples Day, depending on kind of whose set of observances you're going with. There is a strong push to stop recognizing Columbus Day and replace it with Native American Day.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which would be a...
although that push has been going on for a lot
about Columbus,
of years.
It has, hasn't it? It
hasn't happened yet.
Yes, but look who... I mean, we have hope.
I know, there is hope, but it's been talked about for a lot of years.
So there are a few... sort of directions one could go. If you wanted to, take some kind of a bite out of this. One would be look up the Native American Rights Fund, which is, it's essentially the ACLU for specifically Native concerns. And that's NARF.org. Partly just find out about what they're up to and what concerns they are specifically working on. You can find ways to recognize where those concerns play out, for instance, in the Iowa legislative process. And talk to your legislators and say, hey, this is not a partisan issue. This is us actually just taking care of the folks that we took this land from. There is economic development work going on under the umbrella of the Meskwaki Nation. If you want to make sure you're staying close to home. So Meskwaki Incorporated is their economic development arm.
Cool.
And so, they are working on some specific, specific economic development work. I like to pretend it's a tiny little piece of reparations that anytime I'm driving from here to Cedar Rapids on 30, that I stop at specifically on the settlement to buy some of their coffee. Like it's a nothing, right?
Deb, close your ears. Close your ears, Deb.
Does that make you an Indian giver?
That's good.
Oh, there's a word we need to retire, huh?
Deb,
wow, don't ever use that term again. That is terrible. That one and this morning, I said the natives are getting restless, my twin daughters and my twin granddaughters. And my daughter immediately sent me a text because I was Skyping with them. She immediately sent me a text and says, Mom, stop. You need to read this. It's the second time I've heard you use that term. And you need to read about this racism issue that is... And I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm just going through, just did the 21-day challenge and everything that's all involved in that. And I'm so sorry. And she said, it's just the language you're learning. We appreciate that. And thanks. And because I wrote her back and I said, oh, thank you for, there's things we don't think about so quickly. I mean, the girls were really trying to eat breakfast and they were getting up and moving around and doing everything. And I said, it just looks like, you know, things are getting out of hand. Right. And so, but I used that term and it was like.
I heard a show last night, an informational show on late night radio. I couldn't even tell you the name of the program without looking it up. But it was about why Custer did what he did in the larger context of the American West. And that could be exactly the orders that he was given. The Indians are getting restless, make them stop. Now, the question in the show was, how far did that order really go, and how much of it did he make up? And did anybody really give him permission to go massacre the Indians? I don't think it matters anymore. But that could have been word for word what his commander said. The Indians are getting restless, make them stop.
Yes.
Or the Natives are getting restless.
The Natives, yeah, right.
Yeah. Custer. Deb, I wanted to ask you, you have been a public school teacher recently. Aren't you given a whole sheaf of stuff about Native American rights? Maybe not. You are?
Yes, we are. Okay. But we also teach units in history on American Indians. So how much of that is reality and how many teachers know not to make headbands with feathers coming out of them? And it's iffy. It's really iffy on which people know how to do it well and which people do not.
As a teacher in fourth and fifth grade, we did the Native American unit, and each child was challenged to pick a tribe to do a research paper on. I taught them how to do research. And it was amazing how the kids really got into it. They all picked different tribes and the customs and everything. They really got an appreciation of the Native Americans. And that was a highlight of fourth and fifth grade for us to learn about the Native Americans.
And we had, we always had somebody bring a teepee, a real teepee, and set it up for us. The Des Moines or the Boone Y camp would do that. And, I can't remember his name, but his son died trying to rescue a hawk from a telephone line chief. Everybody knows him. He does he's older now, but he started the big day of the they celebrate out at Cuddy's every year. Chief. I cannot think of his name. I can't think of his name, but he's pretty well known in the Des Moines area, and he would go to many schools and teach kids a reality-based education on what it was like to be an American Indian, what his heritage was. And he's the only person I've ever heard mention the seven generations forward and backward. I had always taught it as they look at seven generations and how what every action that they take will affect seven generations from now. But he taught me to go seven generations back. And the man on the TED Talks mentioned that. I thought, I've only heard that twice. And it's a really good lesson. Yeah. But seven generations back is as important.
Wow.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. He wrote children's books. Ralph Moisa, I believe.
Ralph Moisa, that's it.
Bingo.
Fantastic man. And his wife, too. The two of them together have meant a world of difference for the state of Iowa and understanding our history.
That's neat.
Fantastic.
My grandma used to tell me a story about what would be, I guess, my great one great grandmother, how her family was saved from the Spirit Lake Massacre because they were friendly to the Indians and allowed them to come into their homes, to their home. And so when all that uprising was going on, that family was set aside. And so I'm here today because of because my family way back did good things, or at least they were decent to the Indians, the Native Americans.
That's nice.
That's a good start. So this teaching, I love that Bruce and Deb, you've both been involved in teaching and bringing bringing new generations into a better understanding than the one that we grew up with, and I include myself in that, and continuing to learn, and again, Bev, I want to affirm your willingness to take that little texted correction, like, oh, I, you know, one of those didn't even realize that that was a word that we should probably avoid, but it's
thanks to all of you.
Yeah. And it's so easy for us to say those things that, we grew up with and have used a million times before, and to be willing to take that correction, often, is a step toward, being ready to receive a place at a table somewhere. Right, for conversation and to really learn, how can I help? What can I do? And again, there's organizations like the Native American Rights Fund that are already spelling out clearly on a legal end what they'd like to do. The Meskwaki Tribal Council has programs. If you go to the Meskwaki tribal website, you can click through there and see, sort of put your detective hat on and look at what they're working on. And from what they're working on, you can figure out, I wonder where I could, not come fix that for them, right? We know better than that, because we know what mission partnership really needs to look like. But I can get a sense of where some of those needs might be. And, again, chat with your legislator and say, hey, how are you helping with this? Chat with your banker and say, hey, how are you helping with this? The Meskwaki Inc. Does one of their ventures, pieces that they have worked on starting is specifically a bank that is located on tribal land. So, there's all of those questions as well that, are just places that you can, look for, where could my footprint be a little bit better footprint? Mm-hmm. We're going to talk next week about having some of those one-on-one conversations, and the power of those one-on-one conversations, which we all know about, right? We're going to see a documentary on Des Moines Civil Rights Commission project that sat people down for dinner, just one-on-one, across, various political and other divides. Could be sitting down across a divide between an Euro-American settler and Native Americans who are still here. To really actually get to know each other.
That's very cool.
So we're going to take a look at that next week, to try to look a little bit toward what does some of this conciliation, try to keep the word re out of that. What does conciliation look like?
Has to start before we can re.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.